ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to Animal Concerns of Texas, ACT Radio. I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT Radio, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
How we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also talk about why a plant-based diet is the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, or you're concerned about your health, stick around for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Karen Ginsberg, author of the book Animal Impact, Secrets Proven to Achieve Results and Move the World. That's coming up a little later on the show, but first some news.
The Humane Society reports that Texas lawmaker Eddie Lucio introduced a bill that would prohibit the sale, trade, purchase, and transportation of shark fins in the state. House Bill 1579, introduced in the legislature, would ensure that Texas no longer participates in the trade of shark fins and would halt the state's contribution to the global decline of shark species. The Humane Society of the United States and Oceana applauded Representative Lucio for introducing the bill and now urge the legislature to move the bill forward and take a stand against the shark fin trade. If passed, Texas would become the 10th state to crack down on the shark fin trade. Shark finning involves cutting off the fins of sharks, often while the shark is still alive. Sharks are then thrown back into the ocean, only to drown, starve, or die a slow death. The fins are then sold to markets in China and Hong Kong, as well as in the U.S., where they're used as shark fin soup, which is considered a delicacy. Some species of shark are on the brink of extinction due to the exploitation of the shark fin industry. Shark finning is illegal in U.S. waters. However, the fins that are imported and sold in Texas can come from sharks harvested in unsustainable foreign fisheries or finned in the open ocean. The majority of the global shark fin trade goes through China and Hong Kong, which receives their supply of fins from at least 80 countries, most of which have lax and ineffective shark finning bans. In recent years, other states have banned the trade of the product. Texas has emerged as a trade hub for shark fins. Since 2010, the shark fin trade in Texas has grown by 240%, partly due to bans passed in other states which have likely redirected the fins to Texas. Katie Jari, Texas State Director for the Humane Society of the U.S., said that with many coastal states already having eliminated the market for shark fins within their borders, it's time for Texas to end its involvement in the highly destructive global shark fin trade.
Four New Mexico dairy farm workers have been charged with a total of 9 counts of criminal cruelty to animals following an undercover investigation by Mercy for Animals at Winchester Dairy outside of Roswell, New Mexico. Shocking video footage obtained by Mercy for Animals investigator shows workers viciously kicking and punching cows, stabbing them with screwdrivers, violently whipping them in their faces and bodies with chains, and dragging downer cows who were too sick or injured to stand with a tractor, while workers shocked them with electric prods. Immediately after the investigation, Mercy for Animals presented law enforcement with video footage and a detailed legal complaint outlining the clear violations of New Mexico's anti-cruelty laws. While it's important that these four individual animal abusers are held accountable, it's ultimately the owners and managers at Winchester Dairy who are responsible for allowing a culture of criminal cruelty and neglect at their factory farm. As numerous farm investigations prove, cows are all too often subjected to cruel, inhumane, and illegal abuses at dairy factory farms across the country. Recognizing the importance of meaningful animal welfare policies to prevent egregious abuse in their supply chains, some major dairy producers have started to take action. Following this investigation at Winchester Dairy and meetings with Mercy for Animals, Leprino Foods, the world's largest mozzarella cheese maker and a supplier to Pizza Hut, Domino's, and Papa John's, committed to the most comprehensive animal welfare policy ever adopted by a major U.S. dairy company. With this announcement, it's never been clearer that the days are numbered for dairy factory farms that beat and drag cows. Remember, the most important action we can take to help farmed animals is to kick the meat and dairy habit and choose healthy and humane vegan foods. Stay with us. Coming up next, we feature a conversation with Karen Ginsberg, author of Animal Impact: Secrets Proven to Achieve Results and Move the World. Karen has spent more than a decade helping animal protection advocates utilize proven strategy and marketing approaches to get better results. She's worked with the ASPCA, the Humane Society of the United States, PetSmart Charities, Farm Sanctuary, and other groups. Our conversation with Karen is coming up next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, Karen Ginsberg. Thanks for being with us, Karen.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here and talk to your great folks.
Hi, Karen. Can we start out by telling our listeners a little bit about how you got involved in animal activism?
Absolutely. It was a three-step process, but it's three steps. It took me about 10 years, so I won't go into 10 years of detail, but just the quick highlights. I started becoming vegetarian in 1990 after my honeymoon. We already really liked animals, and my husband and I, on the last day of the honeymoon, we saw sheep on a truck, and they were not taking them to the movies. So that really and opened our eyes even more to the plight of animals raised for food. I started becoming vegetarian. In about a few years after that, I was working for Freddie Mac, the secondary mortgage agency, and a woman there was running a vegetarian club. We met periodically. It was she who urged me to get into activism, to go beyond just being vegetarian, but to get involved with animal groups. And so I did the things volunteers typically do. I marched in parades and demonstrations. I worked in a mailroom. I did very typical volunteer types of activities. And then after that, down the road a piece, I looked at the consulting work I was doing that I was not finding hugely satisfying and thought about what might I do differently. And through a process, I was led to becoming a consultant in the animal protection field. So that was long about 2000, 2001, and I've been at it ever since.
Mm-hmm. Long ago, I think I gave up protests and demonstrations. They just don't seem to be effective.
No. Well, they're useful really in the early stages when you need to raise awareness. Alex Hirschaft of Farm talks about the stages of a movement, but we're mostly beyond that in most things. That can be tactics that are used selectively, but really my work is around being very strategic in our activism and choosing the most effective approaches that are going to move people to change.
You know, one thing you mentioned in your book, Animal Impact, is the program called ACHIEVE. Can you tell us what those letters stand for?
Absolutely. The word ACHIEVE is to summarize 7 points that activists can use to make sure we are achieving results, because that's what we're in it for. So the first, the A, is for action and audience. It's that the goal is to know that we have people we are trying to reach, and we only succeed when they take action that helps animals. It's good to create awareness. It's good to change attitudes, but that is not enough. So the focus is on action with audiences we're trying to reach. The C is for create benefits and cut barriers. And what that basically says is that people act when they feel it's in their interest to do so. And so we need to make them see more benefits and fewer barriers to taking the action that we want them to take. And being altruistic towards animals, that can be a benefit. It doesn't have to be just, you know, they get money or they get something that's easier. Being helpful to animals is a benefit, but it may not be a big enough benefit to swamp the barriers that people often see in what we're asking them to do. The H is about how to say something to someone instead of nothing to everyone. Of course, we would like everyone to make animal-friendly changes, but realistically, one size does not fit all when it comes to message, and we have to choose subsegments to target, subgroups that we can speak to effectively and reach them in the most effective way, and then we can also talk to other groups in different ways. But just putting out a uniform message for everyone doesn't work too well. And we're certainly seeing a lot of that now in veg advocacy, where people might be taking out an animal message to a younger audience and maybe using a health-focused message with an older audience because of some different needs and interests. The I, and this is a big one, is I am not my target audience. We are not the people we are trying to change. If they thought like us, they'd already be doing what we want them to do. And so trying to get people to change by using the same rationale that we use, or, well, this is why I do it, isn't always the most effective approach. And we also need to be empathetic that people are in a different place. Again, looking at veg advocacy, for those of us who've been doing it for a long time, it's very easy. It may not be very easy, and often isn't, to the people that we're trying to influence to do it. So that's a really big one. The E is that education is not enough. We need to tell people, we need to educate them on what's going on to inspire them to change, but we need to make it happen. We need to provide other things that make it doable. So, for example, I was involved in a project with the Humane Society of the United States looking at increasing spay and neuter rates in Louisiana and Mississippi. So a lot of that project was about messaging. What's the most effective message to inspire people to spay and neuter their pets? But for a lot of people, it didn't matter how much they wanted to do it. They couldn't afford it.
Right.
It's a poor region of the country. They have other priorities like paying the rent, paying the food. And so a lot of that project ended up being HSUS with a lot of the other groups, ASPCA and PetSmart Charities, investing in free and low-cost spay-neuter in the region to make it doable for people. So we could message forever, but it wasn't enough. Mm-hmm. And again, going back to veg advocacy, that's why it's been so important that we have fabulous products in the markets, we have people working with restaurants, that those are all other things that just go beyond education and take people from kind of thinking about being helpful to animals to actually doing it. Voice matters, that's the V in achieve. It is so important about how we come across to make doing things that are friendly for animals attractive. When we are strident, when we are mean, when we are aggressive, which also often comes from our own hurt and dedication. It's not poorly intended, but we can come across in many negative ways. That doesn't help animals because we turn people off. They don't want to be part of our club of animal-friendly people if it's people who are angry and mean and strident and not empathetic. So there's so much about how we come across. That's why I'm very involved with Institute for Humane Education, which is an outstanding group for people to learn how to be very effective in the kind of outreach they do and the way they come across. And the last piece that really, I'm glad it comes last because it really sums it up, is evaluate, don't guess. We as a movement are finally making some very important strides about really measuring, are we getting any results? We might feel good to go out and do things, and we see a lot of good things happening, but it's very important that as individuals and as organizations, we are taking efforts to look at, are we getting the results for animals that we so want and that we and the animals deserve? So that can be from a very informal people thinking about gee, do I think I'm getting any results with this? And actually the founding of the whole pay-per-view approach, which has been so popular and so effective with paying people to watch videos about how farm animals are treated, that came from one advocate who basically thought about, what have I been doing for 10 years and do I really think I'm getting any results? So that's sort of that informal. To the other end, we have groups, again, like maybe the ASPCA and other groups who are using all kinds of data to measure what's going on in shelters and to implement strategies to save more lives. So that is a bit in the nutshell of that 7-point step of what it takes.
Going back to the V for a moment,
yes.
our voices. It's so easy to be driven by our passion, to be strident, to guilt people into trying to go vegan. Even I fall back into that every now and then, mostly with people who I know are not going to change. A coworker of mine, overweight, diabetes, eats a Whataburger every day. And I just can't seem to get through to him on the health message. I'm beginning to doubt whether the health message, works at all until after somebody's had a heart attack.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. I think we all know people like that, whether it's our coworker or our family. We have the people who are just so resistant. And my advice on that is actually let it go.
Yeah.
You only have so much time and so much energy, and this gets back to how to say something to someone instead of nothing to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of people who want to be veg. There are lots of people who are interested in plant-based eating and need help. There are people who have been veg and would be interested in going back. These people are better priority targets of our time and our energy. If someone is really just sort of dead set against it, they're probably on your list of 100 people to think about, like number 99, and it's so draining because not only is it the time you put into that person, but it's just so depressing and frustrating. And listen, animal advocacy can be hard work, so there are lots of better ways to deploy the time. I would let those people go from a prioritization standpoint, number one. And then number two, in terms of guilt, Nick Cooney, in his wonderful book, Change of Heart, has talked about that the science shows that guilt does not work, that people push back. We see it when we ask people about, you know, here's what you need to do to be a responsible pet owner. They say, I am a responsible pet owner, and how dare you say that I'm not?
Yeah.
And you know, as I ask people at the beginning of the book, my book, Animal Impact, is to think about, we may not all be perfect on every dimension either. Do we only buy clothes that we know have not come from sweatshops, or do we just buy less generally and maybe buy secondhand? Do we recycle everything we could? Do we compost everything? Do we always use the least environmentally impactful form of transportation? Now, a lot of folks in the animal protection world are very thoughtful and holistic, and that's exciting. But I think that any one of us could probably find some issue on which there's another advocate for another issue that would find fault in what we're doing.
Right,
and
right.
Think about if that person berated us or guilted us or did any of these things, would that warm us up to want to take on the action this person is advocating? So sometimes if we put ourselves in the leather shoes of the non-animal advocate, then there's an opportunity to maybe have a little empathy for the people that we're trying to encourage to do something different.
Now you've got me thinking about my non-leather shoes that were made by child labor in China.
Well, and again, we that's exactly right. We all have different compromises we're making, and someone else could be equally impassioned and angry about those.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if we all try to take the attitude that people are doing the best they can with what they know and where they are at the time and are trying to be more positive about then trying to help people be in a different place than what they're able to do and what they want to do, that could be very helpful for how we come across as advocates and the success we achieve.
Also, I am interested in about your E for evaluate. I guess my science background is coming in here. And really, you know, this is something that I've always wondered about is how much actually goes into some of the larger organizations in evaluating their effectiveness. Do they do like statistical analyses, or do they do focus groups, or how do they go about evaluating what is the most effective strategy?
This, in my mind, is one of the most exciting developments in the now about 15 years I have been in the animal protection movement. And some of this was already happening in some of the larger organizations, but a lot of the credit goes to Humane Research Council and Shea Green, which has been a proponent for the use of all forms of market research throughout the movement. So whether it's from finding out up front what kind of things will be effective with people to evaluating on the back end, there's quite a bit going on. So I mentioned the work that HSUS has done on spay neuter. That was a while ago, but they've done work on adoption, as has PetSmart Charities, as has Friends. There's been quite a bit done to understand where are people getting animals, what would it take to get them to adopt from shelters, et cetera. So those are just examples. And that information is available for free, much of it. A lot of these studies have been contributed to the Humane Research Council database, which is called humanespot.org. And advocates can go there and research on their favorite issue and learn about attitudes and learn about what people think so that they can tailor their messages and tailor their strategies to be more effective. It's an incredible resource that studies that might have cost the big groups thousands of dollars can be available for free to any individual advocate. It is humanespot.org.
Yeah, that sounds like a really valuable resource. I've never even heard of it myself.
It's very valuable.
The Humane Research Council recently did a study on recidivism among vegetarians. How many vegetarians go back to eating meat? And it was sort of, you know, an eye-opener and a little bit disappointing if the large number of people who they found go back to eating meat. I didn't want to believe it at first, but what are your thoughts on that?
This is actually one of the most important studies, I think, that's been done in our field, because I think anecdotally we've been talking about it for a while, but to put the numbers on it was pretty shocking. So for people who have not seen the study, and again, available for free through humanespot.org, it was a study of more than 11,000 adults age 17 and over, and use very, you know, good quality questions, not just asking people to self-report if they were veg or vegan, but actually asking what they ate, since we know that a lot of people misinterpret vegetarian and vegan. And what they found was that 2% of the respondents were current vegetarians or vegans. 10%, five times as many, were former vegetarians or vegans. And then we had about the other 88% who had never been veg or vegan. So for every vegetarian or vegan we have today, we have five people who have tried it and not stuck with it. And that explains why, you know, you see so much veg food, you see so many veg things at restaurants and whatnot, yet we have yet to statistically see a proven increase in the actual number of vegetarians and vegans. And that's because, unfortunately, we're sort of losing them out the back door as quickly as we're bringing them in the front door, in fact, faster. And this is critical. Businesses know this, that they focus on retention. That's why if you want to, like, give up your credit card, they'll try to keep you, or businesses will do different things to keep you, because they know it costs maybe eight times as much to bring in a new customer as to keep the customer you have. And in veg advocacy, we haven't focused on this historically. We've basically been all on the front end, and initially we had to be, to create awareness and interest. But then pretty much you'd hand somebody a vegetarian starter kit and say, good luck. You know, we hope to see you.
Yeah.
Well, what it turns out is people need a lot more transition help, especially in the first 3 months to a year, where the HRC study showed that we were losing a lot of people in the first 3 months to a year. And that, interestingly, people who dove into it quickly were actually more likely to fall away than people who were more gradual in their transition. So you're starting to see organizations do some great things to give people more support for a successful and sustainable transition. Farm, when folks sign up for the 10 Billion Lives campaign, where Farm takes pay-per-view to concerts and campuses and shows people what happens to farm animals, they ask them to pledge to some amount of vegan eating. Not necessarily 100%, because that's not gradual. It might be some number of meals a week or some number of days a week. They ask people to have a pledge, which is a good form of commitment, and get people to focus. And then they follow up with a weekly email with additional recipes, with support. So they're really forming a relationship. And that's Farmers just one example. We have other groups working with mentors. We have things like Physicians Committee has the 21-day vegan start program. So there are many different programs out there. But there's a real shift in the focus for it is not enough to get people interested. We have to help them transition successfully so that they will stick with it.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, even here in our Vegetarian Society of El Paso, we have quite a few people that come into the society and then leave. And we need to do a better job reaching out to find out why they left and trying to give them the more support they need. Because you're right, it is a big transition with all the social pressure that there is to eat the traditional American diet that, you know, when people make a change like that, they're getting information from all kinds of other people that, no, you should be eating what you've always ate. You need to come to this party and do this, you know. So we need to provide that support for them.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. If you did some selection exit interviews, so to speak, then you would get some really, really powerful information that would benefit those folks and benefit people after them and benefit the organization.
So in all of your work in looking at group effectiveness, if a person was thinking of starting to be active in animal issues, what group would you suggest they invest their time in?
You know, that's really difficult to say because there are so many good groups doing so much good work. And to be honest, when I first got into the field, I really spent quite a bit of time getting to know different groups. Mm-hmm. The conferences, such as the Animal Rights Conference, which is coming up this summer back here in Virginia again this year, is a great opportunity to meet lots of groups at once and to look at the campaigns that they're doing and to meet the people and to hear their philosophies and to maybe ask them questions about how do you plan a campaign, what do you do. So that's an awesome opportunity to do that in person. Another opportunity would be to just go online and look at what some of the different organizations do and look at the different campaigns. And what I would say is, as a volunteer or someone starting out, it is really good to affiliate with a group that already has some successes so that you can learn from their successful path. Some of that is going to be large, national groups or big regionals, but there are many hugely important and successful grassroots and local groups that have a track record of success that you can learn from. But what I would definitely say is don't start out by trying to reinvent the wheel.
Right.
If you want to do a campaign to get veg options in your cafeteria, in your office place, or at a school situation, or if you want to approach businesses about maybe at restaurants about having more veg options, folks have put a lot of time and interest into doing that kind of thing, and you can find organizations that can help you understand, and they can help you with materials, and they can help you with strategies, and so you get the learning process, and you certainly might bring your own unique spin to it. You may have some things to add. I'm not saying that people shouldn't bring their own creativity and intelligence to something, but there's no need to sit down and figure out from scratch, well, how do I approach a restaurant about carrying more veg options on the menu.
Right. And, you know, I think it's important, too, for someone starting out as a vegan or a vegetarian to have a support group, to join their local vegetarian society so that they have like-minded people they can relate to.
I very much agree with that. I think the local vegetarian societies are sometimes, I don't want to say overlooked, but I think their role and their importance has not been highlighted as much as it can be and should be. And I'll admit to being guilty of that as well, although we have the very fantastic Vegetarian Society of D.C. where I am, because it is the vegetarian societies that are doing so much about retention. And so if organizations look at vegetarian societies and say, well, they're just preaching to the converted and that, you know, they're not doing enough outreach, they're not bringing in enough people, and most local vegetarian societies do outreach, of course, but if people say, well, you know, what about all this other stuff? But this is really important to support people, as you say, and to keep them strong and let them be happy veg as people as role models. Because I think, you know, we've now measured what we're losing when people go back, you know, in terms of the 10% that are former vegetarians and vegans. But what we don't measure is what kind of negative impact does that have on people around them who saw, well, look, that person tried to be veg and they couldn't do it, so
yeah.
I'm certainly not even going to try.
It was too hard.
It was too hard.
It made me sick. We've been talking with Karen Ginsberg, author of Animal Impact, Secrets Proven to Achieve Results and Move the World. Thanks for being with us, Karen. And can you tell us a website, perhaps, where people can go to learn more about your book?
Yes. I would love for folks to read the book. It is a great investment in yourself as an advocate and for the animals. And it is at animal, then there's a hyphen, animal-impact.com.
Well, thanks, Karen. And it's been great talking with you today. And keep up the great work.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Karen. If you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, please visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso website at vsep.org. There you'll learn about our quarterly dinner on May the 23rd at the Country Inn and Suites, formerly the Sunland Park Holiday Inn.
Our speaker is going to be one of our former radio guests, Dave Simon, author of the book Meatonomics. So we hope you'll join us for that event. You will need to reserve in advance on our website at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT, you'll find them at ktep.org. Just click the listen button. Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.